you're developing and, you know, ripening into more complex flavor. The cheese throughout the year is going to vary in fat content, you know, and other little nutrients that could, you know, potentially make a cheese different. But the culture, so you use different cultures for different cheeses, and that'll give it a special flavor. And then the cheese pressing time and weight.
The Culinary Libertarian Podcast, episode 34.
Welcome to the Culinary Libertarian Podcast, where the philosophy is free, but the food is on you.
Hello, folks. Welcome back to the podcast. Dan Reed here. Happy to have you here. Happy to be here. Head over to my podcasts page, culinarylibertarian.com/podcasts, where you can join me in the Eating Liberty Facebook group. We've got lots of great people in there and some chefs, so come in and chat us up. You can also find the buttons to follow me on Twitter and Minds and Gab and Bitbacker, or subscribe to my cooking channel on YouTube. While you are in the interwebs, please do find the show on your favorite podcatcher and like, rate, and leave a positive review. All of those move the show up and let more people find it, and more people who find it are the more people who get cooking. While you are on the podcast's page, you can pick up a copy of my Muffins e-cookbook. Just leave me an email address and get on my email list, or you can purchase it as a Kindle book. You can support the show through donations at Patreon and also with Bitcoin. I appreciate the contributions you've been making, and they do help keep the podcast going. Lastly, you can support the show with social media likes and shares for the episodes as you find them in your feed, or share them from the show notes page itself. I do want to say a belated thank you to Look Ma No Weeds for a 5-star review and a positive comment on Apple Podcast. And an even more belated thank you to Kim and Legendary Man Cave for their support on Patreon. I read in an email the other day about the Churchill Club, which was a student club on the campus of Trinity College in Connecticut. The student body denied the petition, but the college president overruled that and approved the request for the club. 250 students protested this group, 10 students strong, for connections with the Churchill Institute, which sought to encourage scholarship about Western civilization with an emphasis on reading the classics. In the PC culture on campuses today, tradition is bad, and seeking it out makes you an enemy of convention. Learning for its own sake is not good. Learning to parrot the party line is the only acceptable form of learning. Be the enemy of convention. Bite back against the insanity with the Tom Woods Liberty Classroom. Use my affiliate link, culinarylibertarian.com/biteback, and bite back against the education you were denied. culinarylibertarian.com/biteback, and look for the non-conventional Western Civilizations courses with lectures short enough to listen to on the commute, at the gym, or in the kitchen. culinarylibertarian.com/biteback. My guest today is Sonia Rangel of Huizache Creamery in Ashland, Oregon. She makes goat cheeses and shares her knowledge about the cheese-making process with us. Cheese-making is a family craft and one she is proud to continue. I caught up with Sonia at her shop, so there are some workaday sounds in the background. So it goes for the craftspeople. Work, work, work. Welcome, Sonia. Thank you very much for being on the Culinary Libertarian today.
Well, here I am.
Well, here you are. It's been a bit of a technical hurdles to get through here. But anyway, so let's start off with the pronunciation of the creamery and what does the word mean, and then tell me your journey into cheese making.
Right. So it's huizache is a type of tree that grows prolifically on my grandparents' ranch where they had a farmstead creamery. And so I would visit Mexico every year and spend some time on the ranch. And I just kind of inevitably fell in love, you know, with the farmstead aspect of it. And I dreamed of, you know, having a profession that involved the animals, the livestock. And so many, many years later, I finally had the opportunity to raise goats and started making cheese and kind of accidentally started or turned it into a business. So here I am going pro.
And are you exclusively goat milk cheese or do you have cow cheese too?
At the moment, it's only goat cheese. And okay. So, yeah, I do have access now to cow's milk. And so I am going to be planning on some cow's milk cheese in the near future.
Cool. Well, cheese making is about as old as food can be, probably.
Definitely.
Since humans milked animals that
right.
They found some way to make cheese.
Does yeah, it's that- one of the first processed foods.
When they did that, I don't know that they necessarily understood why the science was happening. So I know that rennet now is an ingredient that cheesemakers use to coagulate the milk, and that certainly is used for cows. Is rennet a naturally occurring ingredient in a goat's stomach?
Well, yeah, but it's also in the grass or whatever the animals may be eating. And so sometimes there are natural coagulants in the milk, just depending on the animal's diet. So sometimes you're able to curdle milk without actually adding any coagulant into it because there's some naturally already in there. But it just, you'd never know. So that's why cheesemakers always have to add rennet unless, you know, they can put the milk through significant testing and figure that out through testing. But yeah, there is some natural coagulants in the milk sometimes.
I did not know that it came partly from diet. So can you impact the quantity of coagulant in the milk by changing the diet?
Oh, probably. I'm sure you can. You know, most of the time, livestock are out wandering. But, you know, I'm sure there is a way to manipulate that, no doubt.
Interesting. One of the things that's really fascinating about cheese is everybody, every culture has them. If you look at France or Italy, there are just hundreds and hundreds of kinds of cheeses. And fundamentally, we're just talking about coagulated milk and thyme and enzymes. So how do we get to this wide variety of we have fresh and soft and aged, and how does all this happen?
Well, there's a number of variables. Where can I start with that? You know, there's different types of milk, not only from different animals, but from different breeds and different diets and different regions and so on and so forth. And so that all has an effect on the ultimate taste of the cheese. And then getting deeper into styles of cheese, you know, well, that's also very complex. So which avenue do you want me to take on that?
Well, let's start with just like fresh cheese, like say a mozzarella, which is not really fresh. Fresh cheese would be queso fresco or queso blanco, which I've seen some posts on various social media where they say, make your own ricotta. What they're really making is a fresh cheese, because ricotta, of course, means reboiled. You take the whey, add more cream, and then turn that into cheese. So while
right.
That's a cook's peculiarity, I understand that what they're making, it's probably, I mean, as far as fresh cheese goes, it's kind of bland. You have to add stuff to it. But let's say mozzarella is probably hard, and so there's the buffalo milk mozzarella, which is the famous one. But let's just start with the soft cheese.
Soft cheese. Well, that's pretty simple, in my opinion. And there's a whole variety of fresh cheeses as well. So there's different cultures, and the culture is what gives it more of the flavor. And just depending on what type of cheese you're making, you're going to use a specified culture to flavor it. And then you're going to need a coagulant as well. So you add a little bit of rennet and let it sit. Again, depending on what type of soft cheese, you know, you can let it sit for 8 hours or, you know, overnight or something like that. And that'll give you your curds, which then you have to turn around and usually strain and then probably mold it if you'd like to mold it. But that's very, very simple, in my opinion, and salt it and turn it and salt it again. And that's about it. So I think it's a relatively simple cheese to make.
When you're salting the cheese, now when I recently wrote a blog post about salt, and as a cook, salt is one of the things that cooks just flat overlook. You open the blue box and you've got this white, flaky, free-flowing salt, which turns out that's probably the worst salt you can use in your food. There's so much available. So being in Oregon, I know there are salt makers in Northern California and Oregon. Are you choosing a particular salt for both its obviously sodium content, but also to give it some kind of a unique flavor due to where it came from, or what kind of salt are you using?
Yeah, depending on what I'm making. For feta, I like to use kosher salt. And then I'd like to use like a Mediterranean salt for all my other cheeses.
You've got all this curd. You pull the curd out. You're going to containerize it. I forgot the word you used. But now you have all of this leftover whey.
So correct.
What are you repurposing that into ricotta? What's happening to that? Is it going to feed
It's going to feed pigs.
Going to feed pigs. Of course it does. It makes you perfect. Yeah. Why? So are they your pigs?
And just a local farmer. Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Yeah, she's raising goats and pigs, and so she requested the goat milk whey. I know somebody who's making a vodka from cow's milk whey, and that seemed very interesting to me. Really? But you know, that takes a whole, you know, distillery equipment and all, so I'm not gonna go there.
I never would have occurred to me to make vodka from that.
Apparently you can. They take it through all kinds of filtration and, you know, distillation, and
it's a
process, and I don't need any more projects at this moment.
No, probably not. I'm just really curious. The pig farmer, does she sell that does she slaughter them?
Well, yeah, she sells them whole. Usually just sells them live, and to people who want to take that project on, just get them slaughtered and cut and do whatever they want.
I bet that's some amazing, amazing meat. Hmm.
Oh, yeah, definitely, for sure.
Fascinating. Okay. I think Oregon probably has the same climate as say, Michigan or Wisconsin or New York. So there's probably some good temperature ranges. Do you get into making semi-hard or ripened cheeses or into the hard cheeses?
I do. Yeah, I do.
Mm-hmm. And is there... I'm sure since we have mountains, I haven't checked, but I'm sure we have caves somewhere. But are you buying a bacteria for? Do you make blue cheeses?
I don't make blue cheese. To make blue cheese, you have to have an exclusive aging space, almost an exclusive processing facility. You know, because the blue cheese is so invasive, it'll just infect everything else.
Really?
And so, you know, I'd almost have to make blue cheese exclusively, and that's not really what I want to focus on. I'm not a big fan. I'm not a fan of blue cheese. I have I use a white mold that ends up having overtones of blue cheese, but there's no actual like blue cheese mold in it.
You know, I've seen a picture of that on I think it was the Gorgonzola on a chef's Facebook page, and somebody thought it was a mistake. How do you call this Gorgonzola without the traditional, you're looking for that blue, or in the case of a Roquefort, a green, that presence of that color is really the thing we use with our eyes to identify this is the thing. And it's like, wow. So it looks like a mistake, but apparently it's not. I didn't know this. This is cool.
Yeah.
So blue is out. So obviously you're doing Chev and aged Chev. Is there such a thing as a hard goat cheese similar to a consistency of, say, Parmigiano Reggiano?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I've made a goat Parmesan kind of by accident. Yeah, for sure.
Oh, man. And so did that accident turn into something you wanted to replicate and say, wow, this is something we need to make?
Yeah, definitely. I do. Correct. And that's why there's so many varieties of cheeses, because just any little change can make a different cheese, you know, whether it be a change in quantity of rennet, a change in coagulation time, a change in the amount of culture, or, you know, a slightly different weight of press, aging time, and or conditions. And so there's so many variables that come into play, and that's what makes it so fascinating, aside from, you know, the fact that you're eternalizing milk, you know. And so I like to think of my ancestors traveling on ships, you know, and having cheese as kind of a basic sustenance food, you know. And sometimes when I make the hard or semi-hard cheese, you know, I'm thinking, okay, this has got to be, you know, pressed well enough that it's going to keep during a long journey. So, yeah, it's kind of a connection to my ancestors.
Well, I think all food, certainly every one of us has something that we remember, and cheese is certainly one of those things. And for me, being a Polish descent, the smell of my grandmother's making gołąbki is still oh my gosh, I just would love to have a cabbage the size of a tire just so I can make some more stuffed cabbage. But so memories and food are very well combined and interlinked into our brains, that's for sure.
Oh, definitely.
I want to ask about the rennet. Is that something that you can obviously, you have to, well, I'm not sure this is true. Do you have to kill the animal to get the rennet? And can you get it yourself, or do you have to buy it from somebody?
Well, I buy it from a vendor, a cheese supplier. But, you know, traditionally when an animal was butchered, they would take the bladder and use that as a coagulant, and, you know, or thistle, if, you know, for vegetarian rennet. You know, it's found in some plants as well.
Well, I'm going to pursue that a little bit, because I'm pretty sure once you expire your animal, you're not getting any more milk from that. So people who are getting lots of milk but want to maintain getting lots of milk had to find some other way to coagulate that milk. So there is some sort of a non-rennet category of cheese that's probably hundreds of years old as a class, and I'm not sure this is kind of a inside baseball esoteric question, but is there something you're aware of cheese making without the use of rennet?
Well, like I said, there are cheeses like ricotta, you know, where you're just using lemon to curdle the milk, so you're not really using rennet.
Right. You said something about plants having a coagulant ability.
Yeah, like a thistle. And I think some people have made it from the milk on the fig tree. So, yeah. So I think somebody makes it from artichoke.
Now that sounds interesting. This is great stuff. I've never heard of this. Does it taste like artichokes? Is that just a silly question?
I don't think it does. But Dave, he's got a creamery that he calls Oak Leaf, and he makes his own rennet from some sort of plant that I think is the artichoke, but I'm not 100% sure.
That's it, because I, as a food goes, well, I love an artichoke. That's, I mean, it's hard to clean, but man, are they good.
Yeah. I think it's made from the flour.
Interesting. Well, now this is something to dig into. We have a new rabbit hole to explore.
Yeah, definitely.
I am pretty sure that people who are in the craft of whatever they're doing, in this case, in the craft of making cheese, the people who are doing this they've been doing this for a long time, so they're well aware of what's going on with the food and ways to keep the food safe, because if the food becomes unsafe, well, they've lost their product and so they can't sell it. So there's motivation for the cheesemaker or the winemaker or anybody doing this to follow established best practices, because it's in their livelihood and in their best interest, because the kids got to eat. So a few years ago, somebody at the FDA had this genius idea that they're going to make this rule that now cheese, which has for maybe 1,000 years been cured on wood boards, suddenly can't use wood boards. Now it's going to be stainless steel, because because who knows why? And we won't speculate as to the mental capacities of such a decision maker. It seems like they've backed off a little bit on that, because they had a fair amount of less than enthusiastic response. But I don't want you to put yourself in a pickle, but how is engaging the FDA and people who know nothing about cheese interfering with you who know about cheese?
Well, one thing in my case is I can't use the traditional wicker baskets that my grandparents and ancestors used, because the state inspector, or per regulation, they just don't think that they're cleanable. And so I end up having to use plastic molds instead of wicker baskets that we use traditionally in my family. And as far as aging, they use like a bamboo kind of a draining mat. And so, again, it's not something that I use for aging because of requirements and sanitation reasons. So yeah, I understand, I'm all about food safety, and so I just do whatever I have to do to be in compliance.
And that's probably the right response, but it baffles me that take a look around. We've been on the planet for a long time, and somehow we haven't successfully killed ourselves off by making cheese. So we haven't killed ourselves off yet by making tainted cheese. It's a frustration that you ignore the obvious that we're still here. So obviously it just seems the silliness that we can do without.
Yeah. Well, it can go wrong. So I understand why the rules are in place. And, I'm sure many of people have died, from something going wrong. It just, hasn't necessarily been made aware to us, passed along through history, but, because there were so many diseases back then as well. But, they used to use animal hides as curdling bags, And so, the things they were doing were just very, very unusual. And so, we obviously not going to use animal hides, to curdle our milk now, are we? And hang it, from under a tree, right?
It might be a fun experiment just to see, but
yeah, right.
I think the quantity of product is going to be limited. So
yeah. So, but it's just mainly about the care of the milk, just kind of keeping it temperature controlled, and just avoiding the spoilage of it. I think that's the key to it.
Well,
during the aging as well. So,
right, and that's where the expertise of the craftsman or the craftswoman comes into play, because I enjoy eating it, but I don't really know how to do it. But I trust that the people who do, know what they're doing, because I ate it last week and I'm still here. So, well, obviously they're good at their job.
So. Yeah, well, yeah, there's definitely a lot of regulation above us cheesemakers, and we know, we are told, you know, what the parameters of temperature safety, you know, safety is, and it's kind of nice to have those preset, you know, we know what we can work within, and so it kind of makes it easier for us. We don't have to worry when, you know, things are just spelled out for us.
Let's talk a minute about labeling and what, because I think there's either intentionally or otherwise, there sometimes is a confusion on a label. So some cheeses will read, this has been ripened X number of days, or this has been aged for X number of months. And there is a romance to thinking about that cheese sitting in a cave for a few months, being wiped every day and turned over. And so that's, but what can we really learn from a label that says X number of days in a cave or X number of days of ripen? Is that the same thing? What do we know from that?
In my opinion, it is. I mean, you're developing and, you know, ripening into more complex flavor. And so aged, ripened, same thing to me, in my opinion. But, you know, it's all about the factors, the conditions that are in the environment during that aging or ripening, you know, that are really going to make that cheese unique. So it's all about humidity and temperature and, you know, time and what's in the cheese to begin with. It's the humidity and temperature and what's in the cheese to begin with. So your initial cheese composition plus, you know, the aging factors.
Well, let's talk about cheese composition, because that's something I wouldn't have thought about. To me, I'm just thinking I've got this coagulated milk. I've turned it into curds. I'm putting it into the plastic nut worker baskets to press and drain.
Right.
At that beginning there, what's different there? Is there something different in the coagulant or milk to milk that's changing already what's going in the basket?
Yeah, well, you know, some fat content varies throughout the season, throughout the year, and so you're typically, you know, for a natural cheesemaker, the cheese throughout the year is going to vary in fat content, you know, and other little nutrients that could, you know, potentially make a cheese different. But the culture, so you use different cultures for different cheeses, and that'll give it a special flavor. And then the cheese pressing time and weight. And so you can make a cheese that's drier, same culture, same coagulant, everything the same, but if you press it more than the other, then they're going to be two different cheeses, just because one had more weight, more of the moisture expelled, and so that'll make a difference.
I'm guessing that wintertime milk is going to be a higher fat content than the summertime milk. Is that right?
Yes, correct. Okay. Yes.
And what is that difference? How fat is fat and how lean is fat?
Yeah, you're going to get a creamier cheese with, you know, with higher fat content milks, just going to be creamier. And you might get a drier cheese for the skimmer milk.
What is the highest percentage in the wintertime? What would that fat content be?
Let's see. I'm not sure. I'd have to look. I don't have that information in front of me.
Is there a way that, as a consumer, can you know? This is just a giant question, and it's going to be really challenging to answer. Maybe the answer is no, but is there a way for the consumer to know this cheese was made from wintertime milk versus cheese being made from summertime milk?
I mean, unless you're there personally selling the cheese and explaining that to people, but typically no. So, you know, cheese samples throughout the year are periodically, you know, sent out to the lab, and, you know, by standard, you have to use the lowest percentage of fat content and protein and whatever all else, just because that's the requirement, you know.
No, that makes sense.
You're using the minimum, yeah.
And everything else, I mean, if you get bonus, woohoo, no way.
right.
Wow, the cheese is even better. Oh, that's terrible. You know, no one's going to complain about that. No, that part makes sense.
But, you know, there is standard, bigger cheese companies standardize their milk, you know, and they test every single batch of milk that comes through, and they figure out what's missing, you know, and they standardize it. They add or take away from it and make it all the same.
So
that's what you're getting from the bigger companies. They have the technology and ability to do that.
And this is part of the craft of the cheese maker to know how to respond to, because, you know, the
deficiency, overages or deficiencies. Yeah.
Wow. Okay. Well, this is cool. This is something I probably sort of knew it, but without really thinking about that, this makes a big impact.
Yeah.
We've got the curds in the basket. We're pressing it, and so we can control automatically. We control early on how much water is pushed out by how much weight we push on, and
right.
That makes sense.
And is for that, how long?
And mm-hmm. for weight and duration, is that going to be a change because we want to make a different kind of cheese, or is
right.
All right. And then, so one thing I do know about is as the cheese is sitting in its little place, doing its little ripening thing, obviously the longer it sits there, the more moisture comes out of the cheese, which turns, you can have a nice medium hard cheese turn hard just by letting more moisture come out of it. And so that part I know, but that's a lot of time.
But then as well, you know, just depending on how much humidity is in the aging space, and so that'll offset any release of moisture.
So more things to control.
Right. And sometimes, you know, cheese makers even will vacuum seal the cheese just to keep it from shrinking.
How does that not have a detrimental impact on the quality of the cheese?
I don't know. It's not something that I particularly do. I know Elizabeth over at OSU, she leads the dairy department there. That's what she's been doing. I don't understand, you know, how that affects. They don't particularly make yummy cheese, you know, but I would think that the air exchange is important, you know. So I don't understand that. I think that's just a modern concept that I don't fully understand at this point.
Well, if I'm going to eat cheese, I got to tell you the truth. I want yummy cheese. I don't want cheese. In the academic, there's cheese, but it tastes like shoe nail.
That's been wrapped in plastic for.
No, thank you. This goes back to the romance of the craftsperson making the cheese and tending.
Yeah.
So, you know, washing the rind and just checking every one of them by hand and making sure that, you know, nature is doing what nature is doing. And that's really the thing we're looking for.
Definitely. Yeah. And, you know, we do use, I mean, I don't personally use wood planks constantly, you know. Occasionally I put them in my mini aging cave, but, you know, we inspectors don't like them, but we are allowed to use them because we can always sanitize them and bring them back to normal if there's ever any contamination issue. And that was Gianna Cleese. I don't know if you're familiar with Folia Farms.
I'm not.
She fought state ODA regulations just by doing her own testing and proving, you know, the state wrong. And
well, I like her already.
Yeah, so she's another person you might want to talk to.
Anybody who fights the state is already a big hero. Suppose somebody's inspired to want to make something more than just a a ricotta style or a fresh farmer style cheese? Is this, can they make mozzarella at home? Can they buy a gallon of milk from the store and turn that into cheese? Or is there something missing in that time on the shelf and the pasteurization process? Is the opportunity gone?
Well, I've never personally made cheese with store-bought milk, but I think there are some people that do it and have some sort of success with it. So when you go to cheesemaking.com, it seems like a lot of the recipes, you know, include store-bought milk in there, and they're a great resource for that. And they even talk about setting up a little aging cave and all that stuff. So it's very resourceful for anybody that's looking to explore the cheese making avenue.
Well, I'll put a link for, you said cheese.com?
Cheesemaking.com.
Cheesemaking.com. I'll put a link for them at today's show notes page, which will be culinarylibertarian.com/34. And we'll also put a link for the creamery. And so give us the website for your creamery.
It's wisachecreamery.com.
And I will put a link for that, because if you're like me, you're going to misspell it.
Yeah, and we're also on Facebook. There's more pictures and more information on Facebook.
Oh, excellent. Well, I will put a link to the Facebook page as well. So because this is a food show, and this is sort of an interesting thing to find out, I'm going to ask you a few questions just about food. And this is just like short answer, sort of in the style of the Inside the Actors Studio TV show.
Okay.
So of the five flavors, sweet, salty, bitter, sour, and umami, which one do you enjoy the most?
I would say salty.
What's your favorite food?
Oh, that's a hard one. I'll go with passion fruit.
Nice. Good answer. What's your least favorite food?
That's a hard one. I like everything. Yeah, it'd be hard for me to find my least favorite food.
Okay.
I'm a food lover.
That's all right. What gets you excited?
Well, let's see. The outdoors. Oh, I like nature.
Excellent. What turns you off?
What turns me off? Oh, I don't know. Pessimism.
Ah, very good. What sound do you love?
The sound of birds.
What sound do you hate?
The sound of a fork scratching on a plate.
My daughter, too. She hates that. And what is your favorite food indulgence?
Oh, ice cream.
Do you have a particular flavor?
Oh, I like butter pecan.
That's good. You may not know, many years ago at this point, Haagen-Dazs had a series called Five, and it had five ingredients, and one of their flavors was a passion fruit. And it's gone now. They discontinued it, and I don't know why. It was hands down the best passion fruit anything I've ever had. Foolishness. All right. Sounds like a big truck. All right. Well, I appreciate your time today, and I will have all those links up at the show notes page for everyone to find, again, at culinarylibertarian.com/34. Sonia, thank you very much for your time.
Yeah, thank you.
Have a good afternoon.
You too.
All right, folks, that's going to do it. You can find the Facebook page link to Huisache Creamery on the show notes page, culinarylibertarian.com/34. When you are in or around Ashland, Oregon, stop in and pay a visit. Sonia is retail only at the shop. If this episode has left you feeling a bit peckish and you'd rather not sally forth to a cheese vendor, I'll bring the cheese vendor to you. My affiliate, DeBruner Brothers, based in Philadelphia, is an amazing cheese and gourmet ingredient shop, and they ship. Click over to culinarylibertarian.com/Philly to see all the selections of cheeses and oils and vinegars and condiments to get your culinary idea factory working. culinarylibertarian.com/Philly. And if you're interested in trying your hand at cheese, click through the link on the show notes page for a variety of cheese making kits. You can make mozzarella or Asiago or even a Parmesan style cheese right in your own kitchen. Click the tab for cheese kits near the bottom of the show notes page. And don't forget to pick up my Muffins e-cookbook. And I think donuts is going to be the next one. Have a good week, and I'll see you soon.